David Collins was a member of the Royal British Marines. One day he got on a boat to come to Australia. And this is what he wrote in his diary. All communication with family and friends now cut off. We are leaving the world behind us to enter a state unknown. Collins came to Australia with the First Fleet. And that's what it was like for them, to leave England. It was like going on an expedition to Mars with a hold full of prisoners. We know the First Fleeters set up camp at Sydney Cove in January in 1788, in the middle of what we'd now call a classic Australian summer. Almost straight away, they encountered the people who were already living there. And the two peoples were intrigued and a little frightened by each other. Both the British and the Aboriginal peoples thought each other's way of life was somewhat ridiculous, and it's possible that they equally felt sorry for each other. Susan Boyer is my guest today. She's a writer and she's written a book about those first years of contact between the British settlers and the Aboriginal peoples of the area. And it's called Across Great Divides, True Stories of Life at Sydney Cove. Hello, Susan.
Hello, Richard.
You came to Australia as a migrant from Britain.
Yes.
When you were little. Did you arrive by ship?
I did arrive by ship, yes. Coming through Sydney Heads, I remember that was quite a momentous occasion because we all got up early to, you know, come through the Heads, and the Opera House wasn't there yet, of course, but the Sydney Harbour Bridge was, and it was quite a moment.
Was it what you were expecting to look like?
Well, as a little girl, I was only about seven, I had ideas that Sydney would be like a Wild West setting with ladies wearing colonial dresses and kangaroos jumping around and koalas watching from the trees. I was quite disappointed to see skyscrapers, and I remember thinking, but this is just like what we left.
So why did you want to write this story of the arrival of the First Fleet and the contact between Aboriginal people?
I started investigating the stories of convicts for an earlier book, and the more I read about the convict stories, I thought, this is such a revelation. All I'd learnt about the First Fleet was Governor Phillip, 1788, 11 ships, and it made me realise these are actual people. These are people that are similar to we are today, with the same fears and hopes and wondering what the future will bring for them.
Let's start with Governor Phillip. Was he prepared for the task of starting a colony from scratch, in as far as anyone can be prepared for such a task? What kind of a background did he have?
Well, he knew what it was like below deck. He knew what the discipline on ships were like. He had sailed to the North Sea, and he'd later on went to South America. So he travelled quite a bit. But I think he was also quite humane. He'd seen a lot of suffering at sea through scurvy. But as far as being the leader of a colony, how do you prepare for something like that? There were no walled jails at Sydney Cove, so he really had to rely on the fear of the convicts, the fear of the unknown, you know, what's out there. Before they left England, the London newspapers had dubbed the Great Southland the habitation of cannibals. So Governor Phillip, I'm sure, to some degree would have used that fear to keep the convicts restricted to a particular area.
So the First Fleet set out of England, went across the Atlantic down to Rio de Janeiro, mm-hmm. then they went across again under the Horn of Africa, across the Southern Ocean,
yes.
and then popped up on Botany Bay, which was the site recommended to them by Captain Cook all mm-hmm. those years ago.
That's right.
What state were they in when they pulled into Botany Bay?
Oh, well, they must have been partly relieved, but they'd been through quite a bit. I mean, they'd been through storms, the women below deck, they'd been washed from their beds with water coming in below deck. So they must have been partly relieved about we're finally here after 8 months. But as they looked to the shore and the forest in the middle of summer with, you know, the screeching of cockatoos, they must have thought, where are we? Some people would have been extremely fearful, and others we know were planning to escape. And others were planning to make the most of it.
Were they conscious of how strange they looked to the Indigenous people they were spotting on the shore?
Well, I think it's funny that we always think we're normal, don't we? Although Lieutenant King, who later became Governor King, he'd said, I imagine how strange we must look being fully clothed, because when they looked ashore, the black men they saw walking along the beach were, he said, perfectly naked.
Did the Aboriginal people in the area greet the boats, or were they afraid of them? I mean, they must have looked like alien spaceships or something like that.
Well, apparently they did think they were floating islands coming in from the sea. And later on we find out that they thought the sailors scampering up the masts were possums. So, you know, I think there would have been different reactions, just like the white people looking ashore. There were some people who were afraid. There was definitely curiosity.
Once Philip got ashore with some sailors, there was an interaction with local Aboriginal people. What happened there? Tell me the story of how that unfolded.
Okay, well, this is recounted in a few different journals. The Aboriginal people and the white men were swapping gifts, you know, mirrors for spears and so on. But it was obvious that the black men were wondering, what are these creatures actually? They couldn't really make it out because the white men had smooth cheeks, which the Aboriginal men didn't have. They were fully clothed. Even their heads were covered. In some cases, even their hands were covered in gloves. And they couldn't work out whether they were men or women. And we know this from, you know, the accounts of the journals. And eventually they made their meaning clear through gestures and so on. Their question was, are you men or women? Well, one of the men eventually, after some hesitation, dropped his trousers and the truth was revealed. That really broke the ice because there was laughter and embarrassment. And yeah.
Doesn't the record record that the Aboriginal people, upon this man dropping his strides, let out, quote, a great shout of admiration? isn't that the quote?
That might have been in one of the journals, yes.
Were they interested in the British weapons that they were carrying?
They were very interested. At one point, each group had a display of their weapons. John White, the doctor on one of the ships, he asked one of the Aboriginal men to throw a spear through a shield, and then he fired his gun through the shield, and the Aboriginal man went and looked behind the shield to, he couldn't figure out how that happened. And then he said in with gestures, will that go through me too? Will it do the same to me, the bullet go through my body? At that point, they realised the superiority, or that's what the white people thought. They now saw the superiority of our weapons.
We're getting all these stories from British accounts, aren't we, obviously? Mm. And this was something that would fail later, I know, but there seems to be at least a strong effort here to get into the imagination of the Aboriginal people that they're encountering and to see them as human. Is that right, or is that exaggerated?
I think that some of the First Fleet men, the officers and so on, they really did want to understand. I mean, what I've learnt from looking at the stories is that people have different degrees of open-mindedness and closed-mindedness, and I think some of the men, Watkin Tench, for example, he really wanted to learn about the Aboriginal people and what they thought. And we do know what they thought because later they told the white men who kept the journals. That was another thing that surprised me in the research. We actually have a lot of information about what the Aboriginal people thought. I mean, yes, it was written by the white guys, but there were fairly close relationships developed. So I think we've got a pretty good idea what, you know, the curiosity and the fears and so on that the black men had.
We do know that after a bit, Philip decided that Botany Bay wasn't the go, and so he went a bit further forward and stumbled into what had been called Port Jackson. He realised was the finest natural harbour in the world, Sydney Harbour. Mm-hmm. And so they set up camp there. And there's the infamous story of what happened on that first night when the female prisoners were finally brought out of the holds of these ships. What's your understanding of what happened on that night?
Yes. Okay, this was in February. The female convicts were kept on the ships until tents were put up for them. The account we have is from a journal by Arthur Bowes Smith. He was a doctor on the Lady Penrhyn, which carried mainly female convicts. And he was on the ship when he heard this raucous laughter and carrying on coming from the shore. And he said, and I'm paraphrasing, it's beyond words, the riot and debauchery that's going on the shore. So that is actually the only account we have of what happened that night. And he wasn't on the shore. So
make of that what you may.
Yes, exactly. I tend to think that it's been exaggerated for the purposes of drama and so on. The sexes had been kept apart for sometimes over a year because many of the convicts were in hulks in Britain before they were transferred to the ships of the First Fleet. So they would have been absolutely ready for a bit of a party.
So what do you think then? Who knows? Do you think it was something like a consensual orgy of a kind, or was it more like mass rape of these women? What's your supposition here? And it can only be just that, I know, but
I think there were possibly pockets of partying going on and consensual. And, you know, there was possibly rape went on too. But I also believe, from what I've read of Governor Phillip, that he wouldn't have stood by and said, we'll let this run its course, as I have seen depicted. If the females, particularly the younger females and the more innocent, and there were some, they would have been given protection had they wanted it.
So Phillip, once he got on shore, was sworn in as governor of this new colony of New South Wales. Was he supposed to keep those prisoners under tight guard and get them to perform guarded labour, or was he encouraging them to go and make a life for themselves?
They were doing community work, enforced community work. So their job was to build the colony. Some of them were very reluctant to do any work, and some of them were too weak, actually, to do any work.
Some of the prisoners tried to escape and thought they could get away. Where on earth did they think they were going to?
Well, some of them straight away went back to Botany Bay, hoping to get on the French ships that were there to take advantage of the animosity between the French and the English at the time, I suppose.
Get on a boat to Paris.
And some of them just took off into the bush. I mean, there was a female convict who all through the voyage had said, the minute I get there, I'm escaping. And she did.
To where?
Into the bush.
Presumably never to be seen again by the colonists.
Well, they found a piece of her petticoat some months later and said, look, this is what's happened to her. Don't anybody else try it. But then there was also a white woman seen with a group of Aboriginal people to the north of Sydney. So that could have been Anne Smith as well.
Wow. I would have loved to know that story if that's true. Yeah. Some of them thought they might go to China.
Yes.
Did they think China was that close? Did they have any idea where China was?
Look, most of the convicts had never been to sea before. They had very little idea of what the world looked like. So they were told that China was a place where they wouldn't have to do much work and they'd have a lovely life. So most of them headed south to China, which obviously they were going to take an awful long time to get there. Some of them even were given a compass, and the compass consisted of a piece of paper with an arrow that said north.
It's all right, men. Keep heading north and we'll end up in China. What kind of a relationship was Governor Phillip hoping to have with the local Aboriginal people?
Well, he'd been given instructions to develop an amicable relationship with them. I mean, he needed guides. He wanted to learn their language. That was the plan. And it didn't work the way he wanted it to, because the Aboriginal people watching what was happening in the first settlement were absolutely baffled. I mean, at first they were curious, but we know later that they just withdrew. I mean, they were obviously watching from a distance. There were certain things you wouldn't be able to miss, you know, the drums beating for the gathering of the convicts and for executions and things like that.
Yeah, muskets firing occasionally, kind of thing, flags being raised, that sort of thing.
Oh, definitely.
You'd see all that. But they shunned them, did they?
After that initial curiosity, they withdrew. Governor Phillip was trying to encourage them to come and visit the white settlement. They would interact out in the harbour. The Aboriginal men came and helped with the fishing. You know, they were astounded by how many fish could be caught in a net compared to standing as they did with the spear and spearing one fish at a time. So they were very keen to help with the fishing, but they would not come into Sydney Cove.
Did the British have any idea of what lay west of Sydney?
No, they called the Blue Mountains at that time hills. And because from a distance, they do look like hills from the coast. But no, they had no idea. I mean, they had no idea what kind of animals, what kind of wild animals. I mean, there could have been huge man-eating beasts out there or huge snakes or spiders. They knew about the kangaroo from Captain Cook, but that's about all they knew.
Did they think there might be tigers or lions or something? Well, seriously, I mean, you don't know, do you?
I'm laughing because there's a funny story about that, that in the early weeks of the settlement, one of the officers who writes back to his father and a little bit sarcastically said that, oh, some of the convicts thought they'd seen a tiger in the bushes. And there was another story of them seeing an 8-foot alligator lurking in the bushes outside the tents. I can imagine.
It's a goanna, probably, wasn't
it? Yeah, it probably was a goanna. Yeah. And then a sailor went missing. And then the story a few days later was that somebody sighted another alligator, but it was 14 feet long. So, you know, eventually the sailor was found unharmed.
Yeah. Let's talk about some of the convicts and the more skillful ones. Thomas Barrett. Tell me about the exceptional skills of Thomas Barrett.
His story starts on the voyage. When the ships stopped at Rio de Janeiro in the harbour, a Portuguese vessel came alongside the ship, the Charlotte, to sell fruit and so on. And through their dealings with the merchants, it came to light that Thomas Barrett had produced counterfeit coins. And he'd done that below deck between Tenerife and Rio de Janeiro.
He'd done it on board the ship?
He'd done it on board the ship. And he'd made them from buttons, spoons and buckles. Now, obviously, he couldn't have done it alone. He had the help of a marine who was duly punished. But John White, the doctor aboard Charlotte, said that had the metal been a little bit better, the forgery would have been undetectable. So he was extremely impressed with Thomas Barrett.
You've got a picture in front of you of a work of art he made, which is really kind of, the first European work of art made.
Yes.
In
what happened?
Australia.
Yeah. When they got to Botany Bay, John White, the man who'd been so impressed with him at Rio de Janeiro, commissioned him to engrave a medal, now called the Charlotte Medal, because the ship was the Charlotte. And on the medal, on one side, we have the engraving of the ship, the Charlotte. And on the other side is a list of the voyage. So all the places they stopped at and the dates that they stopped and how many miles they covered. That is one very beautiful record of what happened with the First Fleet. Yeah, as you said, it's the first piece of European artwork made in Australia.
What became of Thomas Barrett, the counterfeiter?
I'm sure when he made the Charlotte medal, he thought that he was going to have quite a cushy life doing beautiful artwork, but he, in fact, was the first man to be executed at Sydney Cove. At the end of February 1788, he was marched before the assembly and hung from a tree for stealing peas, pork and rice on the very day that the rations were doled out to the convicts. So it's, what a loss.
Yeah, I presume he was starving. I mean, he would have been starving like everyone else in the colony.
Yeah, exactly. It would have been exactly the same as the others. But there was food. There was food that some convicts did go out and collect, wild spinach and so on. But I guess he just could not resist stealing somebody else's share.
Eventually, tension between the British and the Aboriginal people started to escalate when convicts began to steal some of the Aboriginal spears and tools that were just left lying around.
Well, the sailors aboard the ships were going back to England and they knew that the spears and so on would bring money as artefacts. The tension was beginning to show and that was very disappointing for Governor Phillip. I mean, he had the convicts and the sailors punished for stealing because he wanted to keep the peace. He wanted to create a relationship between the Aboriginal people and himself. So in the end, he developed a plan to detain some Aboriginal men, to bring them into the Sydney Cove settlement to show them the advantages of a civilised life.
So how did that unfold then, this process of getting some captive men from the Aboriginal population?
Yeah, it was meant to be temporary, not a permanent kidnapping. But he sent his officers across the harbour to detain several, but just brought one man.
And how was he detained?
Well, they held up fish as if it was a gift, because gift-giving was a good icebreaker. And as the men came to take the fish, they were grabbed and wrestled into the boat and tied up. Only one man. And the man's name who was captured was Arabanu.
How distressed was he to be just grabbed like that and seized like that and dragged onto a ship?
One account says that he gave out the most lamentable cries of distress. So he was very distressed. And when he was taken back to Sydney Cove, people came from everywhere to have a look. So he was shaking and he was taken up to the governor's house. They wanted to cut his hair and cut his beard. And Arabanu was quite a dignified man. He would not allow them, as frightened as he was, he wouldn't allow them to cut his beard until he saw it. He said, no, do it to someone else first. So he was eventually brought into the governor's dining room with all the other officers assembled.
Can you imagine his terror of that? Brought into a room like that, he'd never seen anything like that before, with these strange white-skinned people.
Exactly.
Covered in clothes. Yeah.
When he was brought into the governor's house, and this was still being built, the governor's house was still being built, it was a two-story house, and there was somebody looking from upstairs. And he was shocked. How could there be somebody up that high? How could there be a person so far off the ground? So it was things like that. And a bell. They had a little bell and he was shocked by the bell.
And was he served a meal with the governor?
He was served a meal. An eyewitness of when he was brought into the governor's dining room, one eyewitness said he was vastly frightened, so much so that his appetite failed him. After dinner, he appeared more cheerful, and it was afterward learnt he supposed it was intended to eat him. So,
didn't you just say earlier that the British were frightened that the Aboriginal people were cannibals?
Exactly.
That account suggests that Aboriginal people were frightened that the white people were cannibals too.
Yep. And I just imagine some of the officers that night, you know, when they went to bed and they're looking up and thinking over the day, thinking, wow, this man thought we were white savages.
And you know, when you realise you're not going to get eaten, that'll cheer you up no end. So no wonder his mood improved after the meal.
He very quickly actually relaxed into the white settlement, Arabanu. But Arabanu would not touch wine. He would not touch alcohol and even bread and salt. He'd smell, but he wouldn't taste it. He became a favourite with the children. They'd follow him around. He learned English very quickly. They were surprised. They would say a word once and he would remember the word.
Philip's thinking at the time, he wanted to give people like Arabanu the benefit of British culture. Mm. This would be a kind of the gift of civilization, and in return they'd agree to let them have whole chunks of their land. Was that the trade-off?
Who knows exactly how Governor Phillip planned to do the negotiation part, but Arabanu was meant to go back and tell his people, look, these people aren't so bad. There are benefits. You know, they have nice houses where it's warm, and these people give you blankets.
So ironically, Philip was trying to sort of use Arabanu as an evangelist for the British way of life, to sort of experience
the envoy.
It and go. Then the Aboriginal people, who were living quite well off the land and by and large had a better diet than the British, would have been watching nonetheless the British slowly starving to death.
Well, that's what's so ironic. They would have watched the white people line up to be doled out weekly a certain amount of food when there was food all around them. So they must have been looking and thinking, these people are so inferior in their ways. And, you know, the British, of course, felt they were superior. Both groups are thinking the same thing about the other.
Those poor people on the other side of the harbour.
Yeah, we need to bring them into Sydney Cove to show them a better life.
Did any of that work? Was there any interest amongst the Aboriginal people that Arabanu was returned to in actually sampling the delights of British civilisation?
Unfortunately, Arabanu didn't get to go back to his people, because what happened in the meantime was the smallpox epidemic. The white people began seeing native bodies, people dying and sick on the beaches and in the bush.
Did they recognise that as smallpox?
Well, it looked like smallpox from the symptoms. Sailors found two children in different situations dying on beaches, two black children, and brought them into Sydney at the time that Arabanu was there. Now, by this time, he didn't have restraints on him. He could have left. He could have escaped, but didn't. And he was involved in nursing the children. Unfortunately, Arabanu got sick, and he was happy to swallow the medicines of the British. The account says that even though they tasted vile, he trusted that they wanted to help him. But unfortunately, he died, and I have to wonder how things may have been different if he hadn't. The two children, however, did survive. The little boy, he was between 9 and 11. His name was Nanbury, and the little girl was 13, about. Her name was Burong, and they were adopted into families in Sydney Cove. Nanbury was adopted by Dr. John White, and Burong was adopted into the household of the Reverend Johnson and his wife Mary. That must have been such a culture shock, to be required to wear clothes, to have different kind of food, But they did. They adjusted quite well, those kids. And they went on to have long-term relationships with the white community.
How devastating was that smallpox epidemic for
There are different figures, but Governor Phillip himself thought, or Bennelong later, another man who was brought into the settlement, he told the governor that possibly half of the Aboriginal communities that lived around Sydney Harbour were affected.
On air, online, and on your mobile. This is Conversations with Richard Feidler on ABC Radio. Subscribe to our free podcast service. Details on our website, abc.net.au/conversations.
I'm with Susan Boyer. She's the author of a book called Across Great Divides, True Stories of Life at Sydney Cove. Governor Phillip wanted another Aboriginal person detained.
Yes.
That's the word. And he gave the job to a man called William Bradley. How did he describe the job of detaining another Aboriginal man?
Well, William Bradley was, I think, a very sensitive young man. And he said it was by far the most unpleasant service I was ever asked to perform. But, you know, orders are orders. And he went across the harbour and this time brought back two men. And the two men were Bennelong and Colby. When they were brought into Sydney Cove, the young children, Nambury and Boorong, they straight away recognised them. It was Uncle Colby. And Bradley says that by the children, because now the children were interpreting, they learnt that they didn't have children of their own, these young men. Bennelong and Colby were in their 20s. So that gave William Bradley a certain amount of reassurance, I guess, that they didn't have wives and children that they left behind.
Were Bennelong and Colby nonetheless shackled?
Oh, they were. Definitely, they were. And eventually they did escape. First of all, Colby escaped, and he escaped with the shackle on his leg still. And Bennelong was a different character altogether. Bennelong, I suspect, quite enjoyed the attention and became quite the ambassador for his people and could actually see the advantages for himself and his clan.
Did he begin to adopt British characteristics?
Oh, he was very happy to wear the British clothes. It gave him a sense of importance. He enjoyed the taste of red wine.
I wonder what this did for him in the eyes of his people. I wonder if they saw him as important or as ridiculous.
I'm sure there was mixed. I'm sure there was mixed feelings. His lady love, Barangaroo, she was very unimpressed with his interactions with the British. There was no way she was going to conform. She actually did conform to some degree, but she certainly set perimeters.
What kind of a relationship did Bennelong have with Governor Phillip?
I'm sure they exasperated each other at times, but they had a fondness. Bennelong called Governor Phillip Biana, which meant father. Bennelong would accompany Governor Phillip across the harbour, and he showed him an island in Sydney Harbour that he said, this was my father's island, Memel, which I think is an interesting that so early in the piece there was a reference to a piece of land belonging to an Aboriginal person and being passed down from his father. But, you know, I keep coming back to the curiosity that existed between the two groups. They were very eager to learn from each other.
Given that the colony was starving, was Phillip keen to hide that fact from Bennelong?
Most definitely, yes. Bennelong was to have whatever fish he wanted and wine, and he was dined at the governor's table. Whereas by now, supplies were dwindling and a follow-up ship hadn't arrived. And they were just wondering, what's going on? Has Britain forgotten us? Where are the supply ships? Phillip was encouraging the convicts and the Marines to grow, you know, have their cottage gardens by now, but that wasn't terribly successful. But Bennelong was well fed.
How did he escape?
He was being guarded in a room. A convict was guarding him, and he said, oh, I've got a bit of a bellyache, I need to go down to the garden, and jumped over the fence and took off. So the white officers suspected that he was missing his lady love, Barangaroo.
Eventually, some ships came into the harbour with some food. What was the mood in the colony like, I wonder, when that ship of food relief arrived?
Well, they were just beside themselves when there was the signal from South Head that there was a ship on the way, and it was a ship bringing more convicts but also supplies. Well, Watkin Tench, he said that there were tears streaming down. The officers were hugging each other and crying with relief that they hadn't been forgotten.
This is the first contact they'd had with the outside world in three years?
Yeah, almost.
It was the arrival of the Second Fleet. What condition were the prisoners of the Second Fleet?
Well, it was deplorable is the only word. The convicts' rations had been reduced because the more convicts that died, really, the more room they had to bring merchandise that they could sell.
So the captain was happy for the prisoners below to die?
It seemed so.
So you have more room for merchandise to sell?
Yes, yes. Oh. And the convicts who were chained to a corpse often didn't report the fact that the person next to them had died, because that meant that they would at least have that person's ration. So it was just by the time...
Oh, that's real, that's concentration camp.
That is death camp terrible. Stuff, and it? I wonder what the Aboriginal people around the harbour must have thought, because bodies were thrown overboard as they came into Sydney Harbour. It was terrible. And, I mean, some of the marine officers and sailors that were on those ships must have been, you know, horrified. They made reports about what had happened, and they said this, it was worse than slavery. And Philip was angry, so angry about what had happened, that he was quite determined that the captain be called to account. And there was an inquiry, but he was moved on.
Once the excitement of the new arrivals had settled down, Governor Philip turned to relations with local Aboriginal people again. How did he get the opportunity to meet with his old mate Bennelong again?
Yes. Well, officers were heading across the harbour on an expedition, and they came across a group of Aboriginal people who were feasting on a dead whale, and among them were Colby and Bennelong. So they sent a report back to say to Governor Philip, you know, Bennelong's here. So Governor Philip, very eager to meet up with Bennelong again, headed back to get some weapons, just in case, and also some gifts and so on, and some red wine to meet up with Bennelong. But Bennelong was standoffish. There was something going on in Bennelong's head. He needed to make a point that the way he'd been detained in the first place.
Right, he'd been violently seized.
Mm-hmm. So there'd obviously been a lot of discussion, and Governor Philip was sort of lured up the beach away from the boat with his officers in it, and then surrounded, and you have to read the account to actually, it's quite nail-biting stuff. He was surrounded and lured over to one particular man who he hadn't met before, who had a spear on the ground. And as Philip approached him, he picked up the spear and lunged it quite suddenly, and it hit Governor Philip below the shoulder blade and actually went through and came out the back. Now, it obviously wasn't meant to kill him, because had this warrior man meant to kill him, he would have.
I speared him through the heart or something.
Yeah, he would have made sure. I mean, this is what these men did. They could aim. Another man that was there, Henry Waterhouse, he was obviously terrified and ran. He thought the governor's dead. Governor Philip yelled out, "No, no, for God's sake, get this spear out of me." Henry Waterhouse came back, but he couldn't get the spear out because he thought it would cause more damage. And there was a long shaft that was, as they were running back to the boat, was dragging along the ground. So you can imagine the agony,
oh, yeah.
The agony. So they get Philip back into the boat and go back across the harbour, and he thinks he's dying. And so he starts giving instructions and so on. As it turns out, when they get back to Sydney Cove, and a doctor looks at him and he says, "No, you're not going to die. In several weeks you'll be out of action, but you won't die." Now, to read Governor Philip's account of it, as it's almost like he's thinking aloud, why did it happen? As he's writing, he says, "So why didn't Bennelong intervene? Why didn't Bennelong come and stop the man from spearing me? And when I think about it, why did they close around me?" So he was wondering himself, was it an accident? Had the man just panicked and picked up that spear and thrown it? Or had it been some sort of a ritual?
Retribution?
An atonement for what this governor had done, for the, all the things that had happened.
So Philip recovered?
He recovered and he decided to put it down to, I think he called it, an act of the moment. Even though his officers had said, they need to be punished for this, we can't let them get away with it, he was like, no, we will let this go. We will move on. We will not let this interfere with our relationship building.
You could just see that being the trigger for some hideous massacre of Aboriginal people in the area, couldn't you?
But Governor Phillip was quite determined, I think, to make the project that he'd been given work. So after Governor Phillip had been speared, different officers and so on went across the harbour, saw Bennelong, and Bennelong said, how's the governor going? Is he okay? And seemed to be quite relieved that the governor was okay. And eventually, after a little bit of negotiation and Barangaroo, Bennelong's wife, saying, no, don't you go over there to the Sydney Cove, he did visit. And when he came back into Sydney Cove and he had some of his friends with him, he took them into the governor's house and he was showing them different things. And, you know, you can imagine, it was like, look at this, look what that can do. And one of the things he showed them was a candle snuffer. Not many people use them now. It was like a long stick with a little cup on the end that snuffs the candle. But the Aboriginal people had trouble saying the sound S. So Watkin Tench tells the account where he was going, candle nuffer. And his mates didn't understand what he was talking about. And he was like, oh, you people, you don't understand the sophistication of these white people. But I should say at that point that the black men also had their jokes at the white men trying to pronounce their words.
So did Bennelong come to live in Sydney Cove after that?
On and off. I mean, he could come and go, and he set the perimeters at that point. He would come into the Sydney Cove, and many of his people also did, but they made it clear that they would come and go as they wished, and they did. Bennelong and Barangaroo came and ate at the governor's table. Barangaroo, incidentally, had decided that no way was she going to wear these white people's clothes, so all she wore was the ochre body paint. And apparently, from different accounts, she was exceedingly well-made, was one of the expressions. And I think Watkin Tench called her a vixen.
Wow. I wonder what the effect of a semi-naked, beautiful Aboriginal woman had on those men.
Yeah.
There's a more violent story here, the story of the encounter between the Aboriginal tribal leader Pemulwuy and the convict called McIntyre.
McIntyre was the governor's game hunter, so he had a fair amount of freedom to go out into the bush and hunt kangaroo and so on. And we don't know exactly what happened, but he had offended Aboriginal men to the point that one day they were out hunting. They'd gone out, there was a sergeant and a couple of other convicts and McIntyre, and they were waiting in a bit of a brush shelter for dusk when the kangaroos came out. And one of them heard something outside, and it was a group of Aboriginal men sneaking up. McIntyre said, don't worry, I know them, I'll go out and sort it. And he walked toward them and was deliberately speared by Pemulwuy. Now, it was a very different spear to the one that was used on Governor Phillip. This spear was definitely an execution spear.
It was barbed, was it?
It was barbed, and had the spear been pulled out, it would have been immediately fatal. If it's left in, you have a slow, lingering death.
So what happened to McIntyre?
Well, he was taken back to Sydney Cove. He knew. He said, I'm a goner. Now, when he came back to Sydney Cove, some accounts say that he admitted to doing terrible things and that he knew that it was an execution. Whereas later, when Governor Phillip questioned him, he didn't admit to that. So Governor Phillip thought it was an unwarranted attack by Pemulwuy. And something I suspect snapped, because the decision he made later seemed uncharacteristic. He called Watkin Tench and said, I want you to go down to the area around Botany Bay where Pemulwuy's clan is. We have to make an example of these people. I can't just go around spearing people. I want you to take some sacks and I want you to bring back the heads of 10 men, Aboriginal men. Now, Watkin Tench gave the account and he was obviously astounded and horrified. Governor Phillip must have read his face and said, well, do you have an alternative? And Tench said, well, maybe we can just bring some back and send them off to Norfolk Island so that maybe the Aboriginal people think we've killed them. So there was a lot, you know, backwards and forwards. How do we deal with this? Watkin Tench did march off one sunny, hot summer day with, I think, about 40 soldiers dressed in their bright red woolen jackets and carrying their muskets down to Botany Bay, and the stories of them getting stuck in mud and while trying to cross a river and so on make for sort of funny reading if it wasn't such a serious expedition they were on. And Colby, who was in the area at the time, he was one of the men who'd been captured earlier and then escaped, he approached Watkin Tench, and Watkin Tench didn't want to see him because he didn't want to capture him and bring him back. So he said, we decided not to see him in his account. He actually says, we decided not to see him. But Colby came up and said, oh, hello, what are you all doing? And stayed with them overnight, had a meal, and then just walked off the next day. So the whole thing was a bit of a farce.
So Watkin Tench was deliberately trying to be seen and avoided?
Well, that's what you read between the lines.
He didn't want the business of actually having to pick up these men and murdering them, decapitating them.
And then the governor's secretary wrote later that it seemed absolutely necessary at the time to do something like this. However, we thought that maybe the ordering of such an expedition could be enough to prevent something like this happening again.
Then Bennelong became a father and he wanted it to be born at Government House.
Yeah, Barangaroo being quite strong-willed, she didn't want her child to be born there. Governor Phillip had suggested now a far better place would be the hospital. Well, Barangaroo would have seen the hospital as a place of death. That's where people died. So she went off and had her baby, that was secret women's business, in a quiet place alone. David Collins, the governor's secretary, he does come upon her not long after the birth and saw her searing the umbilical cord and wrapping the baby in soft bark as they did.
What happened to Barangaroo?
Well, Barangaroo unfortunately died soon after childbirth and not long after the little baby whose name was Dilbung. That meant bellbird.
So in his grief, what did Bennelong ask of Phillip?
Well, he asked for Barangaroo to be buried in the governor's garden, which she was. Bennelong wanted Barangaroo to be wrapped in a British blanket, but with her basket and her spears and her fishing gear.
Eventually it was time for Phillip to leave.
He became quite sick.
Was he satisfied in the end with the progress he'd made during his time as governor?
He said he was satisfied. He felt that by the time he left, the colony had become to some degree self-sufficient. He intended to come back. Or he said he intended to come back, but he wanted to take Bennelong back with him. He wanted to take a couple of men back with him, and Bennelong was keen. I don't know how nervous he would have been, but he would have had no idea what he was to see. He'd had a taste of what British society was like, but to go to London and see the palaces and the carriages and the shops, it must have been quite an experience.
So Phillip left Sydney on a ship with Bennelong after some 5 years or so as governor of New South Wales. What kind of a town was Sydney by the time he left after 5 years?
Well, there were buildings of stone. There were still a lot of small convict huts, I suppose. The areas were fairly defined by then. So the western side of the cove where the rocks is now, that was the convict section. There was the hospital there. But on the eastern side of the cove, there was Phillip's house. And if you see pictures of that, it's quite a substantial looking building for the time. There was the big farm at the back of Governor Phillips House, which is now the Botanical Gardens. And there was a little brick house on a place that became known as Bennelong's Point, where Bennelong had requested that Governor Phillip build him a brick house in the European style. And that's where the Sydney Opera House now sits. And it's still known as Bennelong Point. Every time I go there now, I think, what would Barangaroo think of the projects that are now being built?
It seems like there are three stories here. And one is the story of this incredible voyage of the British to sail right around to the other side of the world and against the odds do this extraordinary thing to build a colony that doesn't disappear, it doesn't fall over. In the end, it does endure, and it's the beginning of modern Australia. The other story is the story from the Aboriginal point of view, which is the arrival of this alien people, which meant being displaced from their land, smallpox. And there's the third story, which is the story of the contact between both peoples.
I was at a school yesterday and I said to the children, what do you think the stories are going to be about the stories at Sydney Cove? And one little girl said, about the white people coming and killing all the Aboriginal people. And I think that those stories need to be told. I mean, that to some degree, particularly later, did happen. But there were so many inspirational, good stories about interactions between the two cultural groups. I think we need to know those stories as well. And that's what I found was a revelation, to know how many good inspirational stories there were about those interactions.
You spoke to Aboriginal cultural consultants about this.
Yes.
And when they were shown these kind of accounts of how Aboriginal people had responded to the arrival of the British 230 years ago now, about, what did they say about what it was like to read the accounts of Aboriginal people from all those years ago?
Yes. Well, some people did know the stories already, but for a large part, they didn't know the stories either and were quite surprised and said, you know, Aboriginal kids should know these stories too. They're good stories that we need to be told. I think for the most part, people that read the stories, both white and black Australians, said they wanted to know more. And I thought, fantastic, because that's how I felt. The more I read, I thought, I want to know more about what happened. So that was my intention, that people want to know more.
Great to speak with you, Susan. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Richard Feidler. For more Conversations interviews, please go to the website abc.net.au/conversations.